Welcome back everyone to another episode of the show. This is the Daniel Tour. I'm John Adirola. It's Wednesday. That's JR Jackson. Hey JR.
I got an internal memo and it said on Wednesdays we wear pink. But apparently on the damage report we wear blue.
We do. We send out like a document every night before the show to give people an idea of what's going to be on if they're a guest, and I like to put a gif in. And so this was from Mean Girls. Let's see if you can identify the particular gif. Anyway, we got a lot that we're going to be talking about today. Donald Trump said something that some people are saying is anti-Semitic.
Some people.
Because it's anti-Semitic. And so we're going to be talking about that. A couple of people leapt to his defense, making it worse every time. So that's going to be fun. We haven't talked about Rudy Giuliani in a while, but we're going to, unfortunately. We've got an awesome guest going to be joining us to talk about what effect a recession could have here in the US, but also internationally, on right-wing political movements. So that's going to be very interesting.
Because you lefties want a recession so badly.
Well, we're inventing one in the media, obviously. The left-wing wants it, the media is giving it to them. That's how the economy works. Under Obama, right-wingers wanted everything to work out really well. And that's why they assisted in every way that they could for the country to work smoothly. Anyway, we're going to talk about the Electoral College, concentration camps on the border, and then Ted Cruz. Sad sack or saddest sack? We'll break it down at the end of the show. So that should be a lot of fun. But anyway, we're gonna start off talking about Donald Trump, anti-Semitism, some of his recent comments, and it's gonna get a little bit weird. So let's start off with that. Recently, there's been this conversation about the rise of anti-Semitism in the US. Multiple terrorists and would-be terrorists wanted to target synagogues and things like that. And so into that conversation, Donald Trump launches a political attack where he gives a version of the loyalty anti-Semitic argument, as you'll see in this video.
Where has the Democratic Party gone? Where have they gone where they're defending these two people over the state of Israel? And I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
Whew. Okay, so either a lack of knowledge, so they're dumb.
What is
they're
it
that, dumb. That's what is why they vote for these people.
And what is it that they don't know? What are they lacking knowledge
about?
Elaborate. Yeah. Again, it's not hard to be a reporter with this particular administration. It's easy follow-up questions. And I'm not saying being a reporter is easy, but right now it's been simplified for you because there's a simpleton there. So you can easily say, what are they lacking knowledge on?
Yeah.
And then the next part, of course,
is the loyalty.
The loyalty.
So that's the interest. I mean, obviously saying that if they vote for a Democrat, which 70 or 80 or 90%, depending on the election, do, saying that they're dumb, that's just garden variety, maybe anti-Semitic as well, but it's certainly offensive. Mm-hmm. And he knew that going in. Everybody sort of gets that, and that's why they're focusing more on the disloyalty comment. And so there's two different possibilities with the disloyalty argument. Either he's saying the whole they should have loyalty to Israel thing, which is the dual loyalties anti-Semitic trope that the right wing has gotten so fired up about over the past year. Either it's that, or he's just saying they're being disloyal to the United States, which is, you know, a right-wing authoritarian sort of thing, like how dare you turn against us. So it could be one of the two things. And really fast this morning, Rudy Giuliani jumped into the fray to defend the president by saying Trump accuses Jewish Democrats of great disloyalty, the New York Times. This is routine for New York Times and J Street, but really disappointed a rep of ADL would feign confusion about real Donald Trump's statement. POTUS is referring to disloyalty to Israel, which I responded to as, that's the bad part.
See.
And I swore. I'm not gonna say it here, but like, wait, that's not the defense. That's what we're saying the worst case scenario is.
But you know what?
That was Giuliani.
On Fox News, on Washington Times, whatever conservative outlets you wanna list, will then say, Democrats scream that Trump said that they're being disloyal to Israel. Isn't that anti-Semitic?
Yeah.
But they'll say that Democrats said so when this guy just said it.
So he just said it. Mm-hmm. Another huge supporter of the president said the same thing. That is Donald Trump, who this morning clarified to Andrew Feinberg, I mean they're being disloyal to Israel. So like it's so out there, it's so blatant, I honestly don't even know how we're supposed to respond. We spent as a country like 2 months with Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, dissecting every word, every quote to see Is there something hidden underneath their language? Are they implying something like, for instance, the dual loyalties thing? Are they implying that, hinting at it in some way? Donald Trump is just saying they're being disloyal to Israel, which they should be. They should be loyal to Israel by supporting me. They're not. They should support me and Israel. They should have dual loyalties. He's just saying it. It's just out there. So how are you supposed to respond?
American Jewish folks are supposed to be loyal to Israel. I thought they were Americans.
I mean, that's something that a lot of people have noticed for a while. Back in April of this year, he was speaking with a group of, I believe it was Jewish Republicans, and he referred to Benjamin Netanyahu as your prime minister. They're Americans, he's not their prime minister, but that was again, that in that case was strongly hinting at the dual loyalties thing. He also kept referring to your people, to which a normal person would respond, what do you mean your people? But he kept saying it, and now it's just, he's done with the subtlety. To the extent that he can be subtle, he's done with it.
This is the meat behind the things like send them back, when he's talking about Ilhan Omar, send her back to wherever she came from, they came from somewhere else. So even when he thinks he's talking to supporters, which now he's surprised that many American Jews don't support him, it goes to how dare you, oh wait, you have some kind of connection to others. Even the ones he thinks he's friends with, or would be, he's not friends with them anymore because they don't support him. That's his only gauge for having any kind of friendship. But even in saying so, he goes, these are the folks that I'm trying to convince that I'm on their side. But still thinks they have some kind of like international foreign loyalty or connection that doesn't belong in America. Mm-hmm. Even with the positive side, he's like, I'm with you guys. Aren't you with these other guys though? You're foreign, you're weird to me, right?
Yeah, and it's gonna get even worse in just a second. I just wanna briefly say, so we did a breakdown yesterday on the show, I don't know, they all blurred together, but responding to Ben Shapiro and him saying something really disingenuous. And we showed very clearly how he was dead wrong slash lying about previous things that he said. And it really, the response to that, or the lack of response from Ben Shapiro fans, since I didn't see a single person say, you know what, you're right, he's obviously lying, I've lost some respect for him. That buttresses my point that there's no reason debating pundits in this country because no one ever changes their mind no matter how blatant something is. He got out in front of the news this morning saying, well, you know, Trump is being ridiculous, I admit, but it could be one of two things. He could be saying disloyal to the US, he could be saying disloyal to Israel, and that's really different. If he just means the US, then I have a problem with that, but it's not anti-Semitic. I mean, come on, he doesn't mean Israel. If he meant Israel, that's anti-Semitic. And then Trump's like, no, what, did I stutter? I meant Israel. He's gonna backtrack. No one is going to actually hold him or Ben Shapiro accountable. Like Ben Shapiro just laid out a very easy to pass bar. Don't be saying you have to be loyal to Israel. And what's Ben Shapiro gonna say? He's gonna say, you know what, it turned out I was wrong.
Yes.
Turns out the anti-Semitism, it's rot. The fish rots from the head.
Yeah, that's the part I'm missing.
It's not gonna happen.
He'll never say I was wrong. He'll then defend Trump saying that they're being disloyal to Israel. And that suddenly that's an okay thing.
Yeah.
He'll change his mind without admitting that he previously said the complete opposite.
Exactly.
Because it's follow the leader.
So what's the point of any of these debates when you could be as wrong as it is possible to be wrong? Yep. Anyway, I wanna turn to a slightly another defender of the president. So look, Donald Trump is looking horrible this morning. Rudy Giuliani's defense of him doesn't make him look any better. But Donald Trump has a new champion. And I believe in citing this and another quote that we're gonna show to you, he has completely lost his GD mind, okay? So take a look at the tweet he sent out in defense of him on his anti-Semitic comments. So he says, thank you to Wayne Allen Root for the very nice words. So Wayne Allen Root said, President Trump is the greatest president for Jews and for Israel in the history of the world, not just America. He is the best president for Israel in the history of the world, and the Jewish people in Israel love him like he's the king of Israel. Wow. They love him like he is the second coming of God, but American Jews don't know him or like him. They don't even know what they're doing or saying anymore. It makes no sense, but that's okay. If he keeps doing what he's doing, he's good for all Jews, blacks, gays, everyone. And importantly, he's good for everyone in America who wants a job. And then Trump adds, wow. And I add, wow, you, I felt uncomfortable reading that tweet out loud, let alone actually saying, you know what, that guy's got my back, and thankfully he does. So Trump is retweeting someone who says he's like the second coming of Jesus. If Obama had hinted anything like that, the country would have shut down impeachment instantly.
The second coming of Jesus to Jewish folks of the Jewish faith.
Yeah.
Are we going to elaborate on that?
We could go into theologically why that's a ridiculous thing to say. Needless to say, Wayne Allen Root doesn't seem to know a lot about the Jewish faith or any faith, really. He's a crazy person. Did you know that? Did you get that from the tweet? Wayne Allen Root, a guy who parties at Mar-a-Lago, has very close access to President Trump. He has previously said that President Barack Obama attended Columbia University as a foreign exchange student. He has spread the idea that Seth Rich was murdered by Democrats. He said that George Soros hired the guy who killed Heather Hare in Charlottesville.
Oh my God.
He said that Chief Justice John Roberts, his ruling on Obamacare in 2015, might have been because he was being blackmailed or intimidated, and Barack Obama is secretly gay. That is the defender of the president, who also just happens to the cherry on the sundae is that he has a classic serial killer name. I don't know that he's killed anyone, but he's obviously out of his mind, so you might want to keep an eye on him.
Don't quote me, but I feel like there was a previous thing about Wayne Allen Root, and there were some questionable things said about underage girls.
Yeah, he defended Roy Moore. Yeah. He's like, yeah, they looked like they were 20, which is how our laws work. If they look like it, then it's fine.
This is also very, it illustrates Trump's approach to who he was actually speaking to. Like, he's thinking, American Jews don't vote for me. I can't believe it. You guys are totally disloyal to either me, the country, or another country. But then also who he's actually speaking to are American Christians. Because American Christians are the ones who have this they're hell-bent on seeing something play out in Israel because they think it fulfills what Jesus told them to follow. It's this weird roundabout belief that, oh man, Israel, the Holy Land, I have to be supportive of anything that any leader that happens to be there does, or else Jesus is mad at me. That's the American Christian point of view, or some American conservative Christian point of view. And so he's speaking to them when he says, how dare they don't follow me into defending everything that Benjamin Netanyahu does because Israel is the promised land. He's such an idiot and simple about the approach to religion because he doesn't know any of it. He just goes, yeah, you guys like that stuff, right? Yeah. Remember Liberty University? It's the whole ball game, right? It's what you guys like because he doesn't know what he's talking about. So he's speaking to them, and it shows how much he really doesn't understand where he's going with it and actually how, at the end of the game, ironically, anti-Semitic it is.
Yeah, totally. We're gonna go slightly over just because I gotta add, this morning, I believe he was talking about I think it was the trade war. He literally said, I am the chosen one on this issue, Donald Trump. So second coming of God, I am the chosen one. Look, maybe he's just as excited about the Matrix 4 being announced as I am, and that's why he's talking about it. But he said, I am the chosen one. Like, how much do we mock Beto O'Rourke for saying I was born for this? And this, he has nukes. He has many nukes. He has more nukes than I have anything. And he believes he's the chosen one and possibly the second coming of God. And on the anti-Semitism thing, I mean, look, either you get it or you're never gonna get it despite the evidence. But I'm gonna throw a little bit more your way. Mehdi Hasan tweeted out some things that you might have forgotten. Donald Trump retweeted an image of Hillary Clinton in a Star of David as the most corrupt candidate. Ran an anti-Semitic campaign ad, praised the neo-Nazis as very fine people, told US Jews their country is Israel, I referenced that. Back to Soros caravan conspiracy that literally terrorists who have killed Jews in synagogues have themselves spread. He's also spread it and kept a book of Hitler speeches by his bed. And I wanna give our producer Angel a little bit of credit on that last topic. We've mentioned this before, I wanna give you a little bit more details though. So this is the last April, this is actually a ways back now, but Ivana Trump told her lawyer Michael Kennedy that from time to time her husband reads a book of Hitler's collected speeches from the book My New Order, which he keeps in a cabinet by his bed. That might seem like a ridiculous slanderous statement, but no, Donald Trump admits it. Although he said, it was my friend Marty Davis from Paramount who gave me a copy of Mein Kampf, and he's a Jew, which would be odd. That would raise, I think, a few warning signs. Turns out there's some issues even with that statement. So Marty Davis reached for comment, said, I did give him a book about Hitler, but it was My New Order. Hitler's speech is not Mein Kampf. I thought he would find it interesting. I'm his friend, but I'm not Jewish. So he got every part of that wrong. Wrong in a way that would make anyone wonder how could that possibly be true. But he does have that book of speeches and keeps it. And there's another connection to Hitler too, which is sort of weird. So this is from a Vanity Fair piece. Donald Trump appears to take aspects of his German background seriously. John Walter works for the Trump Organization, and when he visits Donald in his office, Ivana told a friend, he clicks his heels and says, Heil Hitler, possibly as a family joke. I don't see how that could be a joke, really. Certainly not of the family variety.
Wait, the friend comes and does this?
Yes,
or Donald Trump does this.
He does it to Trump because it's a joke amongst their family, I guess.
And
anyway,
the small last part of that with the book is, it's also obvious that he hasn't read it at all. No. He would know.
Well, it's a book.
He would know that it's not Mein Kampf, but actually a book of speeches.
Yeah, that if I was Donald Trump, that would be my defense. Do you think I read? Come on, it could be anything. It's not a comic book. There's no chance. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, global recession. It'll be bad for the world, but maybe good for far right populists. After this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Here in the US, we're worried about the possibility of a recession hitting sometime in the next year. And obviously, Donald Trump is worried about what the effect that might have on his reelection, which is why he's spinning conspiracy theories about who would be responsible if there were one, tweeting things like, "The fake news lamestream media is doing everything possible to create a US recession, even though the numbers and facts are working totally in the opposite direction." That's how facts and numbers work. They work in a direction. They would be willing to hurt many people, but that doesn't matter to them. Our economy is so strong. Sorry. So look, he's worried, but should he be worried? Would a recession actually hurt Donald Trump or other authoritarian right wingers like him around the world? And joining us now to break this down, John Haltewanger, politics reporter at Business Insider. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Good to have you here. And you recently wrote an article about the effect that a recession or economic troubles generally could have on right wing populists. And so here in the US, let's start with Donald Trump. If a recession were to hit sometime between now and the election, is that necessarily going to hurt his chances?
Well, conventional wisdom tells us that if there's an economic downturn, it hurts an incumbent seeking reelection. But conventional wisdom has never really applied to Trump. He seems to be the Teflon president. Nothing sticks. And this could also apply to an economic recession in the sense that he is extremely good at scapegoating, and this is a very routine tactic of right-wing populists and authoritarian leaders. He's extremely good at shifting blame. You know, as you just noted, he's already spreading some conspiracy theories about who might be to blame for this economic recession that he's already denying is on the horizon. So, which is interesting. He's both denying that it's possible while also saying, well, if it is possible, here's who's responsible. And his base really seems to be convinced by these types of arguments. When you look at what a lot of experts on populism and nationalism are saying, politics has really become a team sport in recent years. It's not really about the specifics on the issues. It's not about policy. It's about red team versus blue team. And the red team is really stacked up behind Trump, no matter what.
Yeah, I sadly could not agree more on that particular point. When it comes to who he's blaming, though, I mean, look, he has a lot of time, obviously, to change his messaging if he wants to. But right now, I think it's interesting that he doesn't really seem to be blaming the Democrats very much. He's mostly blaming, I guess, Anderson Cooper or like a New York Times reporter. And I wonder, like, strategically, like, we know that his base has been trained to hate the media. That's true. But are they really going to buy that if they're experiencing economic hardship, that it's Don Lemon's fault rather than trying to blame. I mean, he blames the Fed too, but he's not really blaming Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer. Like, focusing on the media, does that seem strategically to fit well into the framework you're laying out on the far right populist side?
I mean, it is an interesting strategy. I've been sitting here trying to crunch the numbers on that as well, in terms of how could you even make the case that the media is responsible for trying to manipulate it, the country into an economic recession. The media didn't fare so well from the 2008 recession, and in many ways is still struggling and reeling from that. So it really doesn't make sense. But he could, in a sense, argue that the media has tried to make consumers less confident in the economy, and this is the cause for the economic downturn. You always see the Trump juniors of the world complaining that the media doesn't cover his economic success enough and only highlights the negatives. So he could definitely continue to or try to continue to argue that the media has undermined consumer confidence, and that's to blame for some economic downturn if it does come in the future.
So at the same time that he's got his own unique brand of right-wing populism, in the Democratic primary you have multiple left-wing populists as well. So if there were to be a recession, look, he's gonna give his messaging, but there will be a counter, ideally, if the right candidate is chosen in that primary. So how do you see that playing out, that the recession could be interpreted in these two very different ways depending on your party identification?
When we look at right-wing populism, it often involves the scapegoating of marginalized groups. Whether it's right-wing or left-wing populism, there's often an anti-establishment, anti-elite sentiment toward it. We saw some of that, after the 2008 recession with both the Occupy Wall Street movement and the Tea Party movement. But yeah, the big difference often is that when it comes to right-wing populism, they're blaming in the U.S., people south of the border, immigrants are taking our jobs is the kind of the mantra. Immigrants are undermining the economy here. So I think in terms of how it might play out with 2020 Democrats, they might continue to hammer Trump on how his policies on taxes have really favored the wealthiest cohorts of Americans, even though he's painted them as helping the middle class and the working class Americans. But we know in reality, we haven't really seen that yet. So I think what we'll probably see from Trump is he's really just going to try to keep his foot on the gas here. That's why we're seeing him attack Jerome Powell. He wants to do anything he can to make the economy look like it's growing in the short term, regardless of the long-term damage. And Democrats will try to call that out as it happens. I guess we'll just have to wait and see who's more convincing.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems like this is going to be a big story either way as we go through the rest of this election. And you've done great work so far in covering it. You had an article recently on how the global recession could boost far right populism, both here and with examples abroad. And everyone watching should go take a look at that. John, thank you once again for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Representative AOC raising new concerns about the continued function of the Electoral College. We'll break that down after this. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez posted an Instagram story in the last day where she was driving through a pretty remote area. There's nobody living there. And she pointed out the sort of ridiculous way that we choose our president based on the experience she was having. She says, "We're coming to you live from the Electoral College. Many votes here, as you can see. Very efficient way to choose leadership of the country." And there she's talking about the Electoral College, which we're going to focus on. But it reminds me of how gleefully, after every election, you'll see Fox News like, "Did you see this? We've got a county by county map of the vote. And look how much of the map is red." Sure, it's mostly like mongoose and like wildebeest, but there's no people there, but it looks good to see a lot of red. But the ridiculous thing is, it's not just Fox News. We really do, we give these big stretches that don't have many people a disproportionate influence over who gets chosen for president, thanks to the way the Electoral College works.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I guess we may get into the approach that AOC had with this. The only possible disagreement I'll have is if we're worried about, first off, the country is full of people who don't know how to change. Anything that happens with change, it's even harder now because of the degree to which everyone can talk openly about it, which is a good thing. But it then digs people in their corner more. So when you start saying like, oh, you guys are ridiculous, crazy, look at where I'm coming from, and kind of making fun of folks who believe in not ever shifting anything in the country, mm-hmm. it's hard to get those folks on your side. So if the end game is to make sure that we get it done, this is the only time, one of the few times where I'm like, the
approach should be,
you should be like, these are the facts, this is why, even if it's, if it could even benefit you folks who don't know how this works, if you actually assess the real situation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my snarky response would be, these are people who say that the very idea of being triggered over something is ridiculous, and you seem to be worried that they would be triggered over
it's
a video.
It's true.
But here's the thing, they will be, obviously, because everybody gets offended. We only have terms that we apply to when people on the left get offended. That's the thing.
Right.
I agree, still, I'm a big fan of her, and so you're wrong. Okay, this is exactly how we should message around it. But anyway, look, she gives more details on why she opposed the Electoral College, and let's just point out, we're about as far from a presidential election as you can be, you know, from the one that happened and the one that's gonna happen. And you're not allowed to talk about reforming the system right near the election. So we're in prime territory to talk about reforming the Electoral College. So I'm glad that she's doing that. So she went on to call the Electoral College a scam and a holdover from the so-called democracy of the 18th and 19th centuries, during which, quote, the founding fathers also brought you the Three-Fifths Compromise, denied women the right to vote, and wealthy landowners had disproportionate political power, which is 100% true. And again, remember, it's not like the Electoral College was set up as a result of a national vote where everyone had an equal say.
Yep.
Just about the most specific group of people possible. All white, all male, all wealthy, all landed, they got to choose. Only the wealthiest, most landed, and whitest people got to choose. Not everyone got to have a say. And so for the people who would say, well, the Electoral College has been around for a long time, and weren't those founding fathers great? How dare you question something they came up with? I can question the bias that they had at that time.
This is why there's only, this is why we have, one of the reasons that we have this approach in American politics and just American life in general. You didn't have to even follow politics to have this ingrained in you, is that we don't talk about the bad things about our history. We only talk about the things we want to show as a glowing term, which founding fathers are the biggest geniuses in the world that came up with this constitution no one's ever thought of ever coming up with. Democracy is this thing that no one else has ever developed, but we've done it. And then that's all, you can't debate it. And then this whole thing about slavery, genocide, anything that we've ever taken part in, let's ignore that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ignore that stuff, it leaves you to be able to gloss over the things like what happens with the Electoral College, because that's an offshoot of that horrible policy. So if we continue to disregard, like Newt Gingrich wanted to do, over talking about slavery, which again, as of yesterday, was a 400-year anniversary from when it first brought slaves over, we don't want to talk about that stuff. Because if we talk about that stuff, we'll be led to have to talk about how it affected voting rights, civil rights acts, civil rights, and also things like the Electoral College. So then when you say, do you guys know why the Electoral College is so messed up? No, because we didn't talk about the thing that led to that being so messed up.
Yeah, and I know that it just, it seems to be, for whatever reason, it's a difference between the right and the left, where the right gets, they lose their mind if you bring up historical realities that cast the US in a negative or even mixed light. And I personally find that to be an intellectually pathetic, weak position. It would be like if I'm like, so I'm gonna ignore the fact that I've twice torn my calf muscle playing sports because I don't stretch enough. And you know what? I'm not gonna think about that. That's terrible. Don't bring that up. I'm just gonna sprint as fast as I want anytime I want. And if it keeps happening, it keeps happening, but I'm never gonna look at what could possibly influence it. That's not smart, okay? And it's even worse, obviously, on a national level. Now, really fast, I wanna give you another quote from AOC. She says, due to severe racial disparities in some states, the Electoral College effectively weighs white voters over voters of color. The rural representation argument doesn't hold up either, as there are rural parts of virtually every state, and popular vote elections show that candidates still visit and center rural communities' needs. The rural thing is important because I've seen a number of different analyses that show how the Electoral College magnifies certain groups' advantage and takes away from others. And there is a racial component, but the component between metropolitan and non-metropolitan areas is way, way bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It has a racial component, sure, but the biggest difference is that it massively overextends the power of rural communities. And I know that like the automatic reaction when you talk about getting rid of it is like, Senator from North Dakota will be like, well, then no one will campaign in North Dakota anymore. They don't now, they just don't. Nobody goes there because they know it's gonna vote red. And by the way, in California, there are millions of conservatives in California. There are whole areas of the state that are hardcore conservative. their votes don't matter because of the Electoral College. Republicans never come, and they might try to get donations from those people, but they're not actually trying to get their vote because they don't care about their vote. It's never gonna matter. The system is messed up. And so she concludes by saying, facts are facts, America. The Electoral College has to go. Right now, by the way, not that it necessarily matters, but recent poll found that 53% of voters say that the outcome of the presidential election should be determined by the popular vote, with 43% saying the Electoral College system should remain in place.
Don't know why.
And that is with virtually no one making the counter argument.
Yeah. And
at this point.
Lastly, when you talk about, when they said, do you guys want these big city libs to make all the decisions for government? Think about whether or not, so when they said, you guys don't care about the others in the middle of the country. So just, they always say this, but then flip it back and say, do you guys think that big city Americans aren't Americans? Why is that question never asked? Do you think, so we should disregard them? Because you're telling us we're disregarding your voters.
I want their votes to count as much as ours and no more. Yeah, but no, people do think that. When you point out that like Hillary Clinton won by millions of votes over Donald Trump, the response will be, yeah, but those votes just came from California. It's in the US.
Last I checked, this
we're citizens, why does that matter? But it does, okay? But anyway, I'm glad that AOC is bringing this up. Hopefully there'll be some progress, although I'm not holding my breath at this point. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. Not long ago, the United States authorized, I think it was $4.7 billion to go to our network of concentration camps all over the country. And you might think that with that kind of money, you can afford to fund pretty much everything. But they did find one thing they can't afford, and that is stopping kids in those camps from dying of easily preventable illnesses. The US won't be vaccinating migrant families in holding centers ahead of this year's flu season, despite calls from doctors to boost efforts to fight the infection that's killed at least 3 children at detention facilities in the past year. So this is not just a thing where you'd think, yeah, ahead of the flu season, especially in crowded conditions, you'd want these people to have these vaccinations. But there have already been deaths from this particular illness, and doesn't matter, they're not gonna be doing the vaccinations.
There's, I don't know if we can get into more details about where this is going, but at least the reasoning behind it. So I'll save it for that point. But this is continuing the same policies that they said that they've gone away from. First, the whole thing about the cruelty of making sure that these damn migrants that come up know that we mean business. You come up here, you're gonna suffer. Mm-hmm. This is just another aspect of it.
It's more cruelty.
It's the other things didn't work. The scare tax about the number of caravans coming up funded by George Soros didn't work. The separation of families after it even came to a head didn't work. Because I'm not sure if they think people watching CNN on their phones while they walk up in the middle of the desert. I'm not sure what they think is going on, but none of that is working. So they're just trying the next phase of this.
Yeah. Well, they give an argument for why they're not going to be doing the vaccinations. We'll see if that will make you feel better about the situation. So this is a spokeswoman who had an emailed statement from CBP who said, in general, due to the short-term nature of CBP holding and the complexities of operating vaccination programs, neither CBP nor its medical contractors administer vaccinations to those in our custody. Here's the thing, while the holdings should be short term, it has been the official policy of the Trump administration to make them as long as possible, possibly forever. We don't know, honestly, how long you're gonna be in there. And so that argument doesn't hold much water, unfortunately.
Well, John, you're over there speculating. You're saying that it's possible that they're gonna hold them forever. The Trump administration on Wednesday said it would unveil a new rule that would allow migrant families to be held indefinitely. What does that word indefinitely mean?
It could mean a long time.
Ending a procedure known as the Florida Settlement Agreement that requires children to be held no longer than 20 days. Yeah. So this in conjunction with no longer administering any kind of flu shots. The reason they're not gonna administer any flu shots is because, hey, these kids have to get out of there soon. So after you say that they're not gonna be there very long because the nature of our holding policies, the nature of our holding policies has changed to where we don't release them any kind of way soon. Yeah. So now you're conflicting again, and it goes back to the end game of brutality.
I've just got another email from CBP spokesperson who says they are shocked and chagrined to find out that people are gonna be held there for a really long time. So let's give you some details on what's happened already. Tragically, at least 3 children who were held in detention centers after crossing into the US from Mexico have died in recent months, in part from the flu, according to a letter from several doctors urging Congress to investigate health conditions at the centers. And I do also urge them to investigate health conditions. But I would say that even before that investigation, maybe people give people the vaccinations. If you are holding people in horrible conditions with, you know, it's not temperature controlled, the hygiene, as we've been told, is not good. They're not allowed to shower and things like that. Soap is in rare supply. With all of those things added together, the idea that you would throw a little bit of disease into the mix, especially as your public messaging around this issue is saying, we don't want these people because they're diseased, as is commonly said on Fox News, it seems, again, willfully to be creating the conditions where more people will die. Now, three kids have already died. To give you an idea of the numbers, previously, before the Trump administration, we'd gone almost a decade without any children dying under US immigration custody. Now we've had three in a matter of a couple of months. The US death rate in children from the flu is about 1 in 600,000. So far, three have died out of 200,000 held at detention facilities. So the conditions are obviously far worse statistically. And they are choosing to make it worse. And so my question would be, okay, so if you make the decision we're not gonna vaccinate, and then we get a report from, you know, Public Citizen or Ken Klippenstein or whoever, it turns out in the next 6 months, 10 kids die, or 50 kids die, or 200 kids die, who's gonna go to jail for that? Who's gonna lose their job over that? For the willful decision to create the conditions that has an inevitable outcome, which is more kids dying of the flu.
That's their job. Nobody. To do that. That was their job to do it. Now, I want to stress that whole thing about we'd almost gone a decade without any children dying in US immigration custody. Trump likes to compare himself to other presidents all the time, specifically Obama. So if there was all this like flood of immigrants coming in that he didn't care about because he just let them just come in, and then none of them died. Mm-hmm. No one was held in these kind of conditions. You have to look at the one variable factor here is that you're in office now and this many children have died when previously none had. So you have to admit this is happening under your watch. Even though you said those flood of immigrants coming in from all these other presidents, if they're still coming in under you, or maybe they're coming in a lesser degree, which you've also claimed, how are we losing children as well? Yeah. It's because your policies directly create that situation.
Yeah.
There's no denying that.
Kids dying from easily preventable illnesses, wait until the pro-life community hears about that. They're gonna be so mad. But anyway, it's a tragedy and unfortunately probably leading to more in the future. Okay, stick around, more to get to. For years now, Ted Cruz has basically been the saddest man in America. He spent the 2016 election cycle just being consistently unmanned by Donald Trump over and over. And it's been years now, and you might think, considering how unpopular Donald Trump is, Ted Cruz would have found something approaching a backbone. But unfortunately not, and a recent tweet makes him seem even sadder than before. It has to do with the whole Greenland debacle, where Donald Trump tweeted something just pathetic and beneath the office of the presidency. It was, I promise not to do this to Greenland, you can see there, with Ted Cruz deciding to put three of those laughing, smiling emojis, which sadly for me is probably my favorite emoji. I don't think I'm gonna use it anymore. But for Ted Cruz, a guy who was personally and viciously attacked by Donald Trump over and over, to now take Donald Trump's pathetic schoolyard trolling and think that it's funny. I don't know, like as much as I dislike Ted Cruz, I still have enough empathy for, you know, any other person to think, like really, can he not be saved even at this late hour? Can he not find something within himself to turn away from Donald Trump, the guy who just wrecked every family member he has?
This is a case study, at least Donald Trump and his effect on the Republican Party, which was already in my opinion, shambles before. But this is a case study in how rampant stupidity and ignorance can sweep through any people who have a normal thought process. Ted Cruz, as disgusting and anti-American as he was before, he at least had a thought process. And the way he did it, he would think things through. He went to school and probably got decent grades.
He considered himself an intellectual.
Yes, he knew. And the thing is, you could tell when he would speak on on the Senate floor about things, you could tell he had a thought process. At least he was smart, even though he was saying things that were deliberately misleading. Mm-hmm. At least he was thinking. The fact that he's been decimated to following stupidity like this.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Yeah, it's like they say, like it, you know, the lowest common denominator pulls everyone else down on that side, including the ones who most consider themselves an intellectual. Mm-hmm. And he definitely does. He thinks he's the Machiavellian guy in the background, and he's just gonna wait this thing out. And once we get past Trump, he's gonna be the next president. And maybe he's right, maybe his grand strategy will work, but right now it just looks sad. And we're not gonna go through all of the greatest hits of Donald Trump attacking Ted Cruz and his family, partially because Ken Klippenstein has already gotten out there ahead of me. By the time I saw that initial tweet, Ken had already responded, similarly quote retweeting something that Donald Trump had tweeted. This is real. He had retweeted this meme of "no need to spill the beans, the images are worth 1,000 words." An image designed to imply that Ted Cruz's wife was ugly. This is in the midst of a presidential primary. Donald Trump retweeted an image attacking the physical appearance of the wife of one of his competitors. And that's Ted Cruz. And so Ken puts the little smiley
faces. And this was the lesser version, because when he said "don't make me spill the beans on your wife," there was this potential.
He implied implication. God knows
that,
what.
Yeah, that there was some things going down with your wife.
Yeah, and so he called him lying Ted for literally years, said that his father was an assassin. He said that his father was a murderer. Like, I love Bernie Sanders. Okay? I love Bernie Sanders. I want him to be president. If he spent a year calling my wife ugly and said that my dad killed a man, maybe I'll vote for him, maybe. But I'm not gonna be doing smiley happy face emojis at that point.
And what you're also
I have some self-esteem.
You're not gonna have a chance to go home, and you don't have any kids, but your wife and your kids look at you when you get back after tweeting things like this, just saying the things you did. Remember, I think it was an introduction to Trump in some kind of Ted Cruz wrote mm-hmm. glowing terms about Trump.
I think it was the Time 100 thing, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. So he was the intro guy who was there to let everyone know who the amazing figure was that you're about to read about.
Oh my God, you gotta lose respect.
There's a point.
I can't speak for anyone's relationship other than my own, and I can barely speak for that. But it doesn't look good from the outside.
Yeah, when you go home, your wife has to say. So you're not gonna defend me at all.
Yeah, and are we still doing this? I guess.
What happens if you're out? And this is the most brutish form of it. What happens when you're out with your wife and somebody walks up and says, "Hey." You have to do something. You have to be like,
yeah,
hey,
he starts crying.
Don't disrespect my wife like that.
Jeez. Anyway, Ted Cruz. So here's the thing. This is the only silver lining for Ted Cruz in this, is that in this particular story, as bad as he looks, Trump comes out looking more pathetic. So look, we've already caught you up mostly on the Greenland thing, where he wanted to buy Greenland, a ridiculous thing, where he accepts that climate change is happening, but won't do anything about it, instead just wants a real estate deal. So Mette Frederiksen, a Danish prime minister, had responded to this issue saying, "Greenland is not Danish, Greenland is Greenlandic. I persistently hope that this is not something that is seriously meant." I persistently hope that as well. Unfortunately, my persistent hopes are always shattered. But anyway, interestingly, Donald Trump was supposed to do a state visit to Denmark, which I just found out about today. Turns out, might not happen though. Donald Trump tweeted this, seemingly diplomatically, saying Denmark is a very special country with incredible people, but based on Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen's comments that she would have no interest in discussing the purchase of Greenland, I will be postponing our meeting scheduled in 2 weeks for another time. The Prime Minister was able to save a great deal of expense and effort for both the United States and Denmark by being so direct. I thank her for that and look forward to rescheduling sometime in the future. So he thanks her as he's canceling a presidential state visit to a foreign country because they, like everyone, thinks it's both stupid and dumb and moronic and offensive to imply that you're gonna buy another country.
He's supposed to think these things. These are things that's supposed to be said behind the scenes in the White House, and then somebody leaks it. Mm-hmm. Or they write a book after he's out of office and be like,
yep.
Remember that whole like canceled visit with the state, with the state visit to Denmark? It was actually canceled because Trump was mad about not getting the sale of Greenland.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be said later.
Yes, in a book, Michael Wolff finds out about it later on.
And you're supposed to deny it because that makes you look bad. You're not supposed to come out and go, hey, you know what, they wouldn't even talk to me about Greenland, so I'm gonna cancel the visit. You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, he's acting like, I don't know if you ever saw Pee-wee's Big Adventure. There's like the petulant guy who wants his bicycle and he won't sell me his bike. Well, I'm not hanging out with you next time. That's our president. And yes, that's the most remote movie reference anyone will make in political commentary this year. But the reason I say petulant is because while that was seemingly diplomatic, today he said that she was nasty and says all she had to do was tell him no. He says he canceled the visit because, quote, "you don't talk to the United States that way."
Oh my God.
Give me your bicycle, Pee-wee Herman.
You know what the United States is to him? Me.
Exactly. You don't talk to me. She was super polite. Your idea was dumb, dude. She was way politer than anyone would be, including me and JR. Anyway, Chair, thank you.
Yeah,
always fun to have you on.
It's always good.
Great to have you here. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. We got a lot more planned for the rest of this week, so you're going to want to definitely see that. If you haven't already, please rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It'd be much appreciated. See you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.